And we are live, ladies and gentlemen, for a new episode of the Electric Podcast. I'm Fred Lambert, your host, and I'm joined by Seth Wintraub. How are you doing today, Seth?
I'm good.
All right, let's jump right in. We have a cool show this week where it's actually not that much Tesla stuff. We have a few Tesla items we're going to discuss, and then we're going to dive into the broader industry because there was quite a few interesting news in the EV space this week, including a few new vehicle unveiling. So we're going to get to that, but let's start with Tesla as per usual, starting with the possibility of a new Tesla roof tiles. So as you know, if you've been following the show, I'm very bullish on the Tesla solar roof, even though we reported on some significant issues early in the rollout. Like we have a customer that we followed in Miami, not Miami, actually, a town in Florida that had a ton of issues on the solar roof installation. But it looks like they're starting to iron out much of those issues, and the rollout is becoming smoother, and it's becoming a smoother experience to be a Tesla solar roof owner. Now, if you remember, because it's been a while since the solar roof has been unveiled, it was back in 2017, throughout the whole, or even 2016.
It's been a while.
Yeah, during the whole, when they tried to, when they were initiating the acquisition of SolarCity, of course, which is now coming back into light too, because Elon's going to be on trial in the next few weeks for that acquisition. But anyway, that's another story. When they unveiled those solar roof tiles, there was actually a bunch of different styles, different designs of the solar roof. You had this smooth glass, this Tuscan glass, the slate roof type of tiles, and the textured glass tiles. So the textured glass is the only one we've seen over the last 4 years. It's the only thing that Tesla actually installed on roofs. But strangely enough, our friends at Tesla Q, the Tesla short sellers, you know, they have this unofficial fleet of planes that fly over Fremont Factory to try to prove that Tesla is a fraud and they don't actually deliver cars, and solar roof is not real either and everything. The guy actually in the post was like, no solar, there's no solar roof in the post. But I mean, they actually found something new about the solar roof, so we'll give credit where credit is due.
Probably clarify that they're not really our friends.
No. Oh yeah, always. So people will think that I'm not kidding here, but I mean, I'm gonna give credit where credit is due.
Yeah.
they flew
they got
over
their drone up there.
I think that's really that's a plane. That's they're
serious.
Known for flying their planes over there, and they take pictures. And we know that Tesla has those homes at Fremont Factory that they're using to both test the solar roof tiles and also test and train people to install the tiles. We know Elon even talked about some kind of little competitions with all the different teams to see who can install the roof faster, because that was a big part of the slow rollout of the solar roof. Just the time it takes to install it. It would take weeks at first. Still take weeks in some occasion. It depends on, of course, all the roofs have different qualities. But now they can get it in a few days, which is impressive. But the picture they got here, so a few weeks ago, they flew over and bolt structure didn't have any tiles on it. Now they flew over it and it actually had tiles. And it's the tiles with some kind of brownish color, almost like, it looks like the Tuscan kind of color, the Tuscan glass. But it's not the same design of the actual slate, the actual tiles in this case. Actually looks just like the current ones, just a different color. So it might be really a brand new design that hasn't unveiled before. And it could indicate that it could be launching soon if they are installing it on the roof right now. If it's the same design of the tiles themselves, just a different color, it isn't necessarily going to be like as much extensive of testing needed in order to bring it to production. So hopefully we're going to see that soon. Something to stay tuned about. All right, next one. We just posted that today, actually. Tesla is launching some kind of new social media platform called Engage Tesla. And it's apparently, well, it looks like it's in its infancy right now, and it could evolve into something else. Right now, it's pretty basic, but at the very least, we know it's going to replace Tesla forums. So a bunch of readers sent that to us earlier today that Tesla on the Tesla forums, and now there's a message at the top that says, I'm never on the Tesla forums these days, but starting March 15, Tesla forum will become read-only. To continue the conversation with the Tesla community, visit engage.tesla.com. So for those of you unfamiliar with Tesla forums, at the early stage of Tesla, like when I say early stage, when it started becoming a bit more mainstream of a company, they came out of stealth mode in 2006, 2008, between those, and became very more popular at that point. They launched their Tesla forums. There was a place for Tesla owners to ask questions, Tesla fans, and Tesla has been known to look in those forums and to reach out to customers that had questions and just use it as a feedback, as part of their feedback loop. They didn't really take care of that forum. They did some improvement over the year, but they pretty much let it die. And the moderation wasn't great. And if you say anything that's not really pro Tesla, didn't go well there. So it's dead now. Basically, it's become a read only forum. It's just basically an archive at this point. It's not going to be a real forum. So now this engage.tesla.com page right now, it looks more like a blog type of thing. There's a blog that you can sign up to, and the way that sign up to leads us to believe like it might be a little bit more than a blog. And the way that they phrase it here in Tesla's description is, Engage Tesla is a new platform for both Tesla's public policy team and Tesla owners clubs. Its goal is to create a digital home base for all our work and make it easier for Tesla community members to learn what's top on their mind for us, take meaningful action, and stay in the loop. We hope you'll join us, get involved. So, I mean, the key things for now is that public policy team and Tesla Owners Club. So, if you know about Tesla Owners Club, the way Tesla has been using them has been through the public policy team, because they create strong communities that are region-based. So if Tesla is trying to do something in that region, for example, they were very useful when trying to push for legislation regarding the direct sales initiative. So when Tesla had what was sales was blocked by franchise dealership model, and it was hard to make ways with the politicians there, they would reach out to their clubs and has them to reach out to their local representative and try to push new legislation that would allow direct sales from Tesla and other automakers that don't have any history with franchise dealership. And other things like that too, mostly the legislative level, that was very useful. So, and right now, if you look at the Engage page, like all the posts are regarding some of those type of effort at the legislative level. So Tesla invites people to share those and everything. But of course, that doesn't really replace a forum at all. But the way we're looking at it, I mean, if you look here, a screenshot of my profile, you can create an actual profile there and you get points. I'm not sure what those are. You get followers and you can follow people. So doesn't really make sense to follow someone if all you can do is comment on posts and that Tesla wrote and share. So I would assume that Tesla is going to build that Engage page into some type of forum or social media platform, whatever you want to call it. But that's just a speculation at this point. What do you think, Sid?
Yeah, it's super interesting. You have the ability to make a profile. You're adding your social media pieces to it. Clearly, there's going to be a lot of interaction. They want to take kind of what was hopefully happening at the Tesla forums and realistically what's happening in other forums, and bring that kind of in-house and kind of keep a finger on the pulse of, like, you know, what the Tesla community is talking about, what's bothering them. And they can they have a little bit more control over the narrative, I guess. You know, they post something about, you know, a Tesla. I think one of the things was like a supercharger getting the application taken care of in some weird place, and theoretically somebody in the local area maybe knows somebody, they make a few calls. I think it's pretty interesting. It's a way to interact with the Tesla community. And it's a little bit more nuanced than the simple forums, and pretty much the only other communication t- Tesla, greater Tesla has is Elon's Twitter account.
That's fair.
So this is kind of interesting.
Yeah, if it does evolve into that, it would be interesting. But for now, it's, like I said, really in its infancy.
I'm surprised they linked to Facebook on this one.
Yeah, they let you link to pretty much every other social media.
Yeah, YouTube.
All right, another news that came out this week that was I thought was interesting, especially in the context of Elon Musk calling for more nickel production, and we actually touched that at the end of the last week episode. If you check that out, so Tesla is a partner in a deal to take over a very large nickel mining operation in New Caledonia. So it's a kind of a controversial deal, or very actually a controversial mine, if you will. So it's a very big mine. I mean, I think it was operated by Vale. Is that how you pronounce that? Vale, V-A-L-E, Valley, Vale.
I'm not sure.
The mining giant Vale, and they bought it, I think, for $6 billion back in 2007. So it's a massive operation, and they had high hopes for it. They wanted to produce 40,000 tons of nickel per year at the mine, and but things didn't go their way. They had a lot of issues at first with the locals too, that didn't like the idea of a giant mine there, and there was even sabotage of the operation there that caused some delays, and they also had a lot of environmental issue and pushback from environmentalists at the plant, because they were using this high pressure acid leach technology that resulted in some spills, some significant spills that also shut down the operation for extended period of times, and also some weather issues in New Caledonia that result, like the things didn't go well, let's just say that, and they were losing money actually on the giant on that giant mining operation, and they were looking to sell it, but because it is a big part of the region's wealth, that nickel, apparently there's some estimate that put nickel reserve, the world, 25% of the world's nickel reserve in New Caledonia alone, which is a very small territory of, like, I think...
it's an island in the South Pacific. Yeah. It's crazy that I had no idea that nickel was even...
I knew that they were big on mining. I didn't know it was that much. I mean, 25% would be a lot. I mean, it's a population, I want to say less than 300,000 people or something like that. I might be wrong on that, but it's not a big... it's not even a country, really. It's a French territory. Yeah, it's a French territory. It was a French colony. But yeah, also the politics there have been difficult. They've been trying to get the independence. I think just last year they tried to get their independence from France, but it was narrowly voted down. So when Val was like, I want to sell that thing, people were very worried where was it going to go to, and they were talking about a Swiss company maybe taking over it, and a company based in Singapore, and finally they came to a deal this week where that company from Singapore, which is called Trafigura, and a consortium of employees of the mine and the three regional provinces of New Caledonia all got together and will own the mine. But the relevant part to Tesla and the deal is that Tesla was named as a technical and industrial partner in the deal. So apparently Tesla will help basically get the mine in shape. So it's kind of surprising that Tesla would have this up, because they don't really have much experience in mining. They do have a lot of mining partners, of course, and they did indicate more recently that they wanted to get into mining, but they were talking about lithium at that point. And now it would be nickel and cobalt. Actually, there's also cobalt being produced at the mining operation there. But so it sounds like Tesla will try to get a more sustainable, environmentally friendly production of nickel at the mining operation there, and on top of it, of course, they will buy the nickel from there. So I thought that was interesting. An interesting move. So yeah, if you haven't been following the nickel through this week, there has a big crash in price that happened. So it's still up like 20-something% over the last year, but it crashed like 12% over the last week. Not necessarily just about this deal, but also some mining companies in China have kind of answered Elon's call of increasing production. So they all call for they all said that they were trying to increase production right now, which led to that decrease in price. But worth noting nonetheless, because of course lower prices of lower nickel prices will improve battery prices too. All right, let's jump into your Chevy Bolt EUV experience.
All right. Well, so, you know, the main takeaway for me was that it's pretty much the same as the Bolt I was driving from 2017 to last year. It's a little bit longer. The EUV is a little bit longer. They're also still making the Bolt EV, and it has a nicer interior, slightly updated exterior, but same powertrain. So that part is disappointing. I've thought from the beginning that if they put a little bit of bigger wheels on it, all-wheel drive, faster charging, and right now it's still the same. It's basically the same thing. LG updated their batteries a little bit, like 10%, but basically you're looking at the same vehicle that was shown at CES in 2016. But to my surprise, Super Cruise on the Bolt EUV was super impressive. And I can't tell if they just found a really good place where Super Cruise happened to work quite well in New Jersey. I don't think that's the case. I think the stretch of road we were on was pretty nutty. But Super Cruise handled it super well. And, you know, having driven my Tesla to the location and home from the location, and then, you know, having not having to put my hands on the wheel was a big difference. And, you know, as I was kind of realizing, like, this is a whole lot lower of a mental load, the Super Cruise is, than Tesla's Autopilot, it kind of dawned on me that, hey, I would rather have not every road in the country mapped. So Super Cruise only works where GM is mapped, and the Post has a map of the US. It's pretty, extensive. Like most interstates are taken care of. You get out west, and, you know, they probably didn't do any of the back roads in like Idaho and Montana and stuff. But you know, around where I live, it's gotten pretty extensive, and you know, most of the eastern part of the country in California is mapped pretty well. So for me, like in the real world, if I was given the option of Tesla's Autopilot and GM Super Cruise, I would get more utility out of the Super Cruise. And the reason why is because when you're in Autopilot, you're not totally, you're forcing the wheel. You're putting some pressure on the wheel in one way or the other, or you got an orange stuck in there, or you're doing something to kind of keep that wheel momentum where it is. And Chevy's alternative, or GM's alternative, is tracking your eyeballs, which should be on the road anyway. And that is it's just a lot easier. As far as keeping in the lane, I found Super Cruise to be at least as good as Tesla. You know, obviously we're going to need to do more testing on that to kind of make a definitive statement, but just the act of being in Super Cruise versus Autopilot is much easier on the Bolt EUV. So for me, that's kind of a big deal. They've gotten, like, GM's done something which I think is pretty incredible in beating, at least for me, Tesla's Autopilot in usability. That said, we know Tesla's upgrading all the time. They have cameras inside the car they could switch to, or they could, enable full self-driving at some point. Seems like a yearly, full self-driving is coming at the end of the year, every year. So maybe one of these times it'll come, and then we can reevaluate the Super Cruise versus Tesla Autopilot situation.
Well, let's play Tesla's advocate.
Advocate, okay.
Sure. We were just talking off air before that, though. It's a $2,500 price to get the Super Cruise on the EUV.
Yes, compared
to Tesla. three. Compared to Tesla, the Autopilot is free, technically.
Yeah. Except it wasn't on the car, so I still have to buy. But yeah.
And then what happened after 3 years of that $2,500? Oh, I just dropped my phone.
So the official pricing hasn't been released for the Bolt EUV, but on the Cadillac CT6 and the Cadillac Escalade, after 3 years of Super Cruise, you have to pay $25 a month, or what is that, $300? Is that $300 a year?
Roughly, yeah.
Yeah, $300 a year, which, you know, like compared to $10,000 for Autopilot, it's not.
Well, it's not. Technically, Super Cruise is closer to Autopilot than FSD. FSD, $10,000. Right. Your traffic aware cruise control and your lane keeping is included with the car, technically. So it is more expensive for sure. Now, I would assume that $2,500 per month, $25 per month is related to actually keeping up with those maps. Cause that's the thing here. You have, if your system relies on mapping, you have to keep up with the map. So you have to go through those routes with whatever like Google map type car that they have to use, right, in order to keep that active. So that's that can be a problem long term, obviously. Well, Tesla's goal with Autopilot and ultimately FSD is that the car is just like a human that doesn't know the maps in its head. It's just, you have to be able to react. Pluses and minus on minuses on both sides, I think. There's no doubt. Of course, I'm playing Tesla's advocate here, even though I'm a big fan of Autopilot. But I would be the first to admit that GM Super Cruise has a giant advantage in terms of driver monitoring that Tesla, like many other things in their cars, they're so focused on, like, we're going to achieve full self-driving, that all the things that would make everything better until they get full self-driving kind of gets on the back burner, which is,
right.
I get it. Like, I get it. Like, cause if you do get the full self-driving, it's such transformative. It's life-saving,
right,
in many aspects. Like, you can literally, if the faster you get there, the more lives you're going to save.
And it changes.
Yeah, it changes everything. Entirely. I mean, Tesla just wins. Like, it wins at the auto industry. Like, forget the $500 billion valuation. Forget the $1 trillion valuation. They'll own it. They own the whole industry if they do get there faster than everyone, like they say. But they keep missing that deadline. So if you keep missing that deadline, and we kind of skipped that article, by the way, I just realized now. In the FSD beta program, there's been, like, it was launched back in October, if you remember. Over the first 2-3 months, maybe, of the beta program, there were a lot of updates, but updates have slowed down in 2021. But now there's a big one apparently coming that Elon has been teasing, and he now says that it's coming next month, so it should be in April. And it will coincide with a wider release that also has been pushed several times of the FSD beta. So maybe something to look forward to, but like it's hard to take Elon's timelines on this one very, very seriously.
Yep.
Oh yeah, anything more on the EUV experience?
Well, so the bigger picture thing is, like, Chevy is really pushing the price of solid long range EVs down. The Bolt clearly is, like, if your budget's like, $12,000 to $15,000, you can buy a used Bolt EV right now, easily. Like, pretty much every state in the country's got something, online. So with this, they're going to keep pushing EV prices down. We're seeing, some 2020 and 2021. Bolts going for just over $20,000 after all the incentives. So I think the big story with the Bolt is, like, it's getting the Bolt into more people's hands. And it's a good car to boot. It's not quite as nice as a Tesla all around. I mean, I would say a lot of ways it's okay, on the same level, but there's a lot of things that Tesla does a lot better. But I still miss my Bolt. I used to drive it. I have nothing but good things to say about it. Obviously, GM could have upgraded the charging speed and done some other stuff, like all-wheel drive. But, that's kind of the trade-offs. And that was the big story, I guess, is that GM knows that it can upgrade these things, but they didn't do that to keep the price down.
Yeah. Good point. All right. A car that was unveiled officially this week, or at least a production version was unveiled, though we weren't shocked by the design because we've seen pretty close to it, the Taycan Cross Turismo. So it's sort of the wagon, or I think Porsche preferred a crossover. So it's called Cross Turismo, but this thing, yeah, a practical version of the Taycan, if you will. The final design apparently is polarizing. I mean, if you remember back when the concept of the Cross Turismo was unveiled, I pretty much thought it was unanimously loved by everyone. Now they launch it, and some people love it, still love it. Some other people are like, yeah, there's something wrong with it. So a lot of people, it looks like two cars smash it together. Like they smash a Macan and a Taycan front to the back of a... is it the Macan? Was it called the little crossover?
Yeah, no.
Panamera, no, well, the Panamera does have a wagon version, does it?
Right. Yeah.
But I think it might be because of this fender section right here. But right. That's on the Taycan period too, like just a Taycan sedan. So if you're familiar with the Taycan, you're like, no, this is not like. I get a little bit what they're saying, but I'm still a big fan of the design.
Also, it's raised off the ground a little.
Well, yeah, that's the big difference here. So you get very similar performance and everything that you get in the Taycan, but you have of course a bigger interior thanks to the different form factor, and also just better versatility thanks to the higher ground clearance. So the ground clearance is 20 millimeters, so 3/4 inch higher than a Taycan, and doesn't sound like much because it's not that much, but the Taycan is quite low. So there's that almost inch more makes a big difference. But you also have air suspension, so you can get it a little bit higher too from that. And then you also can get an off-road design package that gets an additional 10 millimeters, so 0.39 inches.
Or a centimeter.
Yeah. Yeah, 1 centimeter. Yeah, you're right. So, I mean, I don't know, off-road. I wouldn't really take that off-road, to be honest with you, but...
Yeah, they call it gravel.
Yeah. But if you combine all of that together, though, you do get some decent ground currents for a car. So that's nice. But other than that, nothing too crazy here. They do talk about the difference from the inside. I have that somewhere. Yeah, okay, so... It's 1.35 inch extra headroom in the front. But that wasn't necessarily a problem already for the Taycan. In the back, it's almost 4 inches more headroom. So that's a big difference. It was small in the back for the regular Taycan. Then you get 15.7 cubic feet in the trunk. If you lay down the back seat, that goes up to 42.8, which is a significant difference from the sedan version. In terms of powertrain, everything is the same. You benefit from the 800-volt system, the fast charging that's in the Taycan. They didn't discuss the range, but here was something that I find interesting. So people were already complaining about the range of the Taycan, and now with the Cross Turismo version, a bigger version, less aerodynamic, more weight, people are assuming, well, you're going to lose some range there, and it would be a safe assumption. But now I'm thinking that maybe... We know that Porsche was extremely conservative on their EPA range with the Taycan. Like, obviously, it gets to 100 miles, but people have tested it over like 250. I know you were getting a lot more when you test drove it. And I think, is it MotorTrend that got like 290 almost out of it?
Yeah.
Or Hedman's. So
I feel like it was Car and Driver.
Maybe. But anyway, we know they are super conservative about it. So maybe the use, because they can change a multiplier. Like the EPA said, you can advertise up to this range, but then you can change a multiplier to advertise a lower range. We know Tesla has used that in the past. Other automakers have used that. But they might have done that to use a different multiplier for the Taycan Cross Turismo and still get I would be surprised if they get 200 miles of range all of it officially, because that would be weird compared to the Taycan, but who knows? It's a possibility. You're going to be able to get it in the 4S Turbo and Turbo S version. The Turbo S version will get you 2.7 seconds 0 to 60, which is like pretty fast for a car that size. It's just 0.0 seconds slower than the sedan Turbo S. So pretty good.
I have to say, I like it in green a lot.
Yeah, it looks good, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see the picture.
They got the bikes on the back. So we covered the bikes as well. Micah did.
Yeah. I didn't post about that, but yeah, if you can check it out, Micah did an article on it. The launched two very expensive Porsche e-bikes.
Very Porsche.
Yeah, it does look good in green. I like it. $90,000 is a starting price. It will go up easily over $150,000 if you get the fully equipped version. And it's coming this summer in the U.S., so stay tuned for that. If you have any questions, by the way, post them right now in the comment section, and we'll get to them pretty soon. We have two more news items to discuss before getting into the comment section. So aside from the Taycan, Trust Turismo unveiled this week, Volvo also announced unveiled a new C40. So we already have the XC40. Now we have the C40, so an electric SUV. People are like, yeah, this is basically an XC40. Like, what's the difference? Actually, some difference under the hood and everything, because this is actually the first car from Volvo that's designed just to be electric. So the XC40 was still on the same platform. I should say the XC40 Recharge, because that's their whole thing now. They call it Recharge. But the was a gas-powered XC40. Now there was the electric part XC Recharge, and this is the C40 Recharge, but there's no Volvo C40 in their lineup. It's a brand new car developed on their platform from the ground up to be all electric. So if you're familiar with the designs at Volvo, it's very much the same, very, very much in the same line as the XC40, with the front fascia being basically identical. A more coupe version, let's say, than the XC40 in the back here.
How do you think? I mean, that kind of reminds me a little bit of the Polestar. I wonder if it shares a lot of the same.
I think it's more SUV-like than the Polestar 2, which is like looks to me like a raised sedan.
Yep.
The interior, you benefit from the same interior as the Polestar thing that gets all the Google stuff in it. It was an Android-based entertainment system that used a bunch of native apps from Google, including Google Maps. That was very appreciated by Polestar owners. And battery pack, 78 kilowatt hours. They are talking about 420 miles. That's 420 kilometers, 260 miles of range on the WLTP standard. The EPA, they don't have the official estimate yet, but on the reservation page for the U.S., they talk about over 200 miles of range. So we know that that's another one, Polestar, where they and Volvo Polestar, they're not the most efficient cars out there, but they still do get decent range over 200 miles thanks to a significant size battery pack for a vehicle that size, because this is like a smaller SUV size. And it's going to enter production this fall in Belgium, and it's going to come to the U.S. later this year.
I don't know if... how many readers or how many listeners are in Manhattan, but if you sign up to Volvo.com, they're actually showing it in Manhattan next week. So you can go check it out in their, I think, West Side location.
Yeah, well, one thing that's missing that maybe they're going to release in the debut in the U.S. would be the pricing information that we don't have yet.
Yeah.
All right. Then I have an interesting tidbit of information that came out about Rivian this week. They're going to get into battery cell manufacturing, and they're going to go directly to solid state, apparently. We know that based on not an announcement from the company, but 6 job openings that are related to battery cell, solid state battery cell manufacturing, all in Palo Alto, California. So we don't have much details on it. Rivian has made deal with battery cell manufacturers in the past. They never talked about going into solid state. They never talked about going into battery manufacturing themselves. But looks like pretty serious, because six jobs, all engineering jobs related to manufacturing, specifically manufacturing the cells. So something to keep an eye on. A lot of people place solid states reaching commercialization that makes sense for electric vehicles closer to mid-decade. So maybe it makes sense that Rivian is right now investing in it. We know that the company is flush with money too, so it makes sense for them to be looking at, very at least looking into cell manufacturing. But yeah, it's something probably to look forward to in a few years from them. Nothing to come. Like, don't expect to get a R1T electric pickup truck with solid state batteries this year or anything like that. All right, let's jump into the comments.
Not a lot today, but we'll jump in right now. Can you speak more about the unused part of battery packs? Are you aware of any data? I think we're talking about when, for instance, a Ford Mustang Mach-E has a 95 kilowatt hour battery pack, but they only have access to 88 buffer. Kilowatt hours.
Buffer, you talk?
Yeah, I think it's...
Yeah, I like when companies do release that information. I mean, we know we sort of get used to that with Tesla. Tesla never released that information, but we know with the kind of big community of a hacker that kind of formed around Tesla vehicles, especially salvage car and everything, we kind of get more information on that. And Tesla kind of varied with just like a few kilowatt hours, really, like some 3 to sometimes 6 max on the battery pack. I would say a buffer. And then you add companies like Audi coming on the space with massive buffers of 8+ kilowatt hours. Same thing with the Jaguar I-Pace, and more companies started releasing that information. Like Mercedes also had a big one that they talked about, but they don't do it all the time. So for that Volvo, for example, that C40 Recharge, we don't know about it. Porsche might have released it for the Taycan. I would need to look into that. Do you know if Chevy did anything with the Bolt on that front?
There was something actually, because of the fires.
That's right.
About how we know that the 2017 through 2020, they put an artificial buffer on there, until they figure out what's going on with the fires. They're supposed to, know something by April or have a hardware update. We know that the, 2021 models have a smaller, stated kilowatt hour, so it's 65 kilowatt hours versus last year with 66 kilowatt hours. So the assumption is that they're putting a bigger buffer on the same battery pack, or even it might be a bigger battery pack, but a bigger buffer.
So 66 kilowatt hour when they released that, that you think that was the usable capacity of the pack, not the full capacity?
I think so. So 66 was last year, and then this year it's 65 kilowatt hours, which, like, you would imagine that they're not getting smaller. They're just theoretically just putting a bigger buffer on there.
Yeah. Wait, we have.
So, yeah, that's buffers. All right. Just a PSA. I checked with Tesla yesterday, and they still want a $5,000 upgrade fee for a Model 3 SR to an SR Plus. Do you think that price will eventually lower to reflect the price drops that Model 3 has had?
I mean, that's crazy here. Like, so you bought your car for $5,000, and Tesla wants $5,000 to match. I guess the price reduction came with the 2021 version too, and so you don't get the same car, but you technically that's a better car too. So I mean, so you, for $37,000 right now, you can get a better car than you would get with paying overall $40,000 for your standard range. To become a standard range plus with the few like the autopilot and
might be better just to trade it in. Is there anything else besides the battery that you get?
Well, autopilot is standard on the standard range plus. So,
and then also, isn't there do they like heated seats or something?
Yeah,
like
there might be a few convenience things. Like, I don't remember the list anymore because I mean it's been so long since that was offered. But
right,
there's a few things for sure that makes this $5,000 and I don't know.
A little bit more palatable. All right. Gagan Mago says Norway is producing nickel more than 40,000 tons, and it's superior purist. So this is obviously a representative of the Norwegian nickel producing.
I mean, it might be true. There's different variation in purity of your nickel. I mean, some nickel cannot be used for battery production because it's not pure enough. But yeah, I know that Norway is a big mining country, but don't know how much nickel they produce.
All right, so we get a little clarification. Does the unused part of the battery pack stay constant and therefore take up more percent of space as the pack degrades? Any data to support that larger buffer prolongs battery life? That sounds like a lot.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. Certainly not for Tesla vehicles, but it might be for the bigger. The bigger pack might be something that they calculated into, like Audi, for example. I could see them using that. If you have like an 8 kWh buffer, some of them even mentioned that it's for the longevity of the battery pack. Now, the longevity of the battery pack, maybe like if you don't access that 8 kWh, that increases the longevity of the battery pack, but it also can mean that if you calculate the degradation of the pack based on the range capacity that you get out of the pack when on a full charge, And that is that you get a warranty on that up to 70%. Well, then if you get closer to that 70 threshold where you could get a pack replacement, they could just unleash like a 2 kWh out of that buffer and save the pack like that. I don't know.
All right, moving on. Nobody is loving. So I'm loving the Cross Turismo.
Me too.
And then Pablo says, totally about the Taycan. It looks like the front has been photoshopped.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people saying that, but I think it's just, it's the angle because of the hair, it's not a hot take. Is that what you call it? Where the air goes out. It's the same thing on a Taycan. So,
yeah, I don't quite get that. I think, you know, all new cars, all new like body shapes take a little getting used to, and
this you can see it better here.
Yeah, but yeah, like you said, it's on the regular Taycan as well. All right, any thoughts? Leo Wilson asks, any thoughts on Volvo's promise to move to 100% electric by 2030? Sounds more optimistic than we are used to hearing from other legacy automakers.
I mean,
we heard Volkswagen said today. 70% electric by 2030, which I think is going to be upgraded soon as well. But GM also promised electric by 2035. So it's becoming a pretty common thing to be all electric in the 2030s.
Yeah, I mean, you have to put them in context of their size too. So it's all about converting their production capacity to electric vehicle production. For Volvo, that's a lot easier, a much smaller automaker than Volkswagen or GM. I think, yeah, it's one of the better approach, I think, 100% electric by 2030. I think that's a good goal to have right now. It's not like unfeasible for your investors. You're like, what are you talking about? We have giant factories right now producing internal combustion engine and you want to switch that to electric vehicles. But 9 years, it's obviously doable. Now the Volkswagen, the announcement that you referenced today, it's actually 70% for Europe and 50% for US and China, which I think is, I mean, they doubled it. They say this, that's what the announcement was. We're accelerating our EV transition, doubling our target for 2030. But you know what is going to happen in 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is, like in the 2 to 4 years period, they're going to double it again. They were like, oh, we're going to double it. We're very aggressive. You should. You're not aggressive. You don't have good planning. You don't understand the market. Like,
right.
No one's gonna want to buy an internal combustion vehicle in 2030. And if you're planning for 50% of your production capacity to be producing those, well, you're planning for 50% of your capacity to be useless at that point. So,
I mean, I kind of feel there's a little bit of the like we don't want to obsolete like 80% of our business or 90% of our business right now. So if we say, yeah, we're going all electric in 5 years, which, you know, maybe that's possible. But if you say that, then you've basically obsoleted
your whole somebody entire, else will do it for you, though. Like Volvo right. just did. Volvo was like, no, we're going to be 100% electric by 2030. So why are you going to be 50% if we're going to be 100%? So, yeah, I guess there's definitely part of that happening in the discussion for the announcement in those boardrooms or whatever. Like probably, you know, some executive said exactly what you just said. But, I mean, at the end of the day, because we know what's going to happen. Like, people always say, like, oh, you cannot go switch 100% electric in just a few years. It's just too much production capacity to switch. There's no, we don't have the supply chain for it and everything. And I'm like, you're right. That's always going to be true, though. Like, switching to electric vehicles is such a massive shift for a giant industry like the auto industry. There's going to be bottlenecks everywhere. So, for the legacy automakers, it's all about fixing those bottlenecks as soon as possible. But their plan has to be transition as soon as possible, and just trying to secure the battery supply. And some of them won't have it. Some people just like what's happening right now with the microchips, and some automakers have to shut down production because they cannot produce a car. Same thing is already happening with electric vehicles, and it's going to get bigger, where they cannot secure their battery cells. And they cannot make that transition. But the only difference is right now you still have consumers, I don't want to say dumb enough, but maybe, like, if you're buying a new car right now and it's not electric, if you have the money, like, I'm not saying if you're like in the used car market and you don't have the budget for a new car, or if you think that, I also understand the argument of, like, new cars are also not very environmentally friendly instead of just buying a used one for the energy that goes into producing a new vehicle. But other than that, if you're in the market for a new car, especially for luxury ones, if you're not going electric, like, you're shutting yourself on the foot in terms of resale value, long-term resale value, and also just, I think, the experience overall, because I think the best luxury vehicles right now are electric, are the Teslas, the Audi e-tron, the Taycan, and all those. So, yeah. So it's all about who's going to be able to secure that production capacity to be 100% as soon as possible. So I'm not saying that that's going to be the case by 2030, like, especially for a Volkswagen type that makes millions and millions of cars a year. So maybe that's what they're saying, and they're working to secure more of that production. But, and so that's why they're announcing it like that. But at the same time, because if they don't know that, then they're going to have useless production capacity.
They should say something like at least 80%. Yeah. That would be a little
But then, why you're proud of saying, like, hey, we're accelerating, we're doubling our production of SDs. Like, if you're doubling your targets, that means you were, like, way wrong the last time you made those targets. That's all it means to me when they announce that.
Right. And everybody, you know, not everybody, but a lot of people are pretty adamant that the only thing stopping, like, the total, I mean, basically, it seems like right now, the only thing that's slowing EVs down, adoption down, is the, you know, getting the cells. Like, everything else is kind of pointing to, like, if people could buy an EV, they would. But the cells, getting enough nickel, et cetera, is keeping the price high, artificially high. So batteries are costing a little bit more. Mm-hmm. They're harder to get. They can't procure enough. So in that case, they're keeping some internal mm-hmm. combustion cars around, you know, in their forecast. To me,
there's also the argument of, like, the charging infrastructure is not quite there yet. But I mean, in most places, it's getting pretty close. Like, you can get by in most places. You can. It's completely convenient. It's more convenient, I would argue, than gasoline. Some places it's as convenient. Some places you can get by, but yeah, you have to do different planning and everything. But it's catching up so fast. I mean,
yeah. All right. So we're back to Porsche Taycan. The Porsche website promises that similar WLTP range than Taycan. I mean, yeah, it's the same car.
That makes sense. Yeah. So they were more conservative a little bit with the Taycan, and then because you're going to, especially for the EPA, you're going to want to have a 200 somewhere in there. Like, if you get a 190 something, some people.
All right. Wayne O says, any info on the higher energy storage capacity of lithium sulfur batteries?
I'm not that familiar with sulfur, lithium sulfur chemistry.
We do a story every once in a while on them. I'm again, not too versed on that. Auction Wheels, when do you expect the Bolt to get the new battery GM LG will be making? I will say I don't think the Bolt will ever get that battery. Unless it's such a popular car that they want to keep the namesake around. I think the Bolt will probably be around to like 2024. And at that point, if it's a loved car, then they'll make a GM Ultium version of that. But there's nothing in the roadmap that shows the Bolt getting the Ultium battery. That said, I don't think GM would publish the, wait a couple more years and I'll get the faster charging, cheaper
battery. There's a clear line between like all the Ultium vehicle coming out and the Bolt EV and the EUV. Think they would keep the EUV though? Because there's also like the Super Cruise thing, like the Super Cruise available on the EUV, but not on the EV. So maybe they're going to phase out the EV, but at least keep the EUV during the Ultium transition.
You know, it was interesting. The GM Chevy people were asking me, like, what do you think? Because they have an interesting manufacturing process where they can make 25% EVs and 75% EUVs or the reverse, depending on what the market wants. And they were saying, well, what do you think it's going to be? And I said, well, for me, I would buy a Bolt EV, if you could put Super Cruise on it. But I think most Americans are going to like the look of the EUV because it's longer. It looks like every other
crossover
out there. It's just people are more used to something like that. It looks, more rugged, I guess. And they were like, yep, that's pretty much what everybody's saying. So I think we're going to see a lot more EEVs out on the road. It's only like $2,000 or $3,000 more expensive as well. All right. We're getting close to the end here. There has been a fire after the software update in the Kona in Korea. And now the batteries will be replaced.
Yeah, we did a report on that.
That's true. And we're hearing that LG is taking 70% of the cost. So it sounds like it might have been a little bit more of an LG problem than a Hyundai problem.
So maybe GM is also going to have its cost covered for that.
It's weird because GM says they can fix it with a software update and you're going to get your range back. But, there are different packs, different BMSs and everything. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. What is your current take on the future of bidirectional charging capability? Reference from Electric's 5 2020 article, car to car house, etc. Well, I think it's a big deal. It would be nice if there was some products out there that could do it. Right now, the Nissan Leaf is about the only shipping product that can go backwards.
But even that, you need... You need a product to make it work. You need that bidirectional charging station, if you will. Ioniq is interesting for because it does require an adapter if you want for the thing. But it's a smaller product. It's not like a charging station. So and you can directly plug things through regular outlets through that. So that's interesting too. But there's a future for an integrated like Powerwall like bidirectional charger for your car. I have to assume that's coming at some point. Like just a neat, it might be expensive, but like it would be a Powerwall and you get all the advantage of a Powerwall. And at the same time, it's like a direct access to a generator. Like if you have like a prolonged outage, well, you can plug your car through it, and instead of charging your car, it's going to charge your car's going to charge your home in a seamless way.
Yeah, for me, I really like what the Ioniq can do. We don't know all the specs of it, but just having a plug there, you can kind of use it as a backup generator. If your house goes out of power, you can run off your car for a few days. That would have been good for folks in Texas, for instance. I think that's just a big value add. Like you've got this electric car, you're thinking about spending $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 on it. But if we can replace a $5,000 generator as well, then it makes the purchase price easier.
Yeah. I think for Tesla, it's going to be a no-brainer to bring a product like that because they already have both sides of the business. They have the solar stuff, and like a lot of people with the solar get a Powerwall install anyway. And they do try to do cross promotion between the vehicle consumers and the solar consumers. But that would be the perfect link between the two. Like, hey, with your Powerwall, we can get you a bi-directional charger Powerwall system that can charge from your solar, can charge your car directly from the solar with that, and vice versa. If you have an outage and the Powerwall is not enough for keeping the energy, well, you can plug your car through it and the car will send energy back to your home too. It just makes perfect sense. Maybe when the Cybertruck is going to come out, things like that, where, I mean, a Cybertruck, a lot of people like this, I want a Cybertruck because I do off-roading and I do big work with my truck and everything. But let's be honest. A large percentage of people are going to buy those and just use them as regular cars. So they're going to have giant battery pack in there that they're not going to use most of it most of the time. So that makes a lot more sense now to have a second function for it, backup power.
And our last question is from Bert Boyd. How should countries and cities be considering adding the appropriate charging stations to meet the growth in demand?
I mean, it's DC fast charging. Yeah, I mean, but right. We've seen that problem getting solved lately. It's just, if you're a long time EV fan, you knew like that was so frustrating at the beginning, where a lot of cities, a lot of countries were announcing like, oh, we're going all in into charging infrastructure. Like, we are accelerating EV adoption by investing in charging infrastructure. And then they will announce like thousands and thousands of stations, like get big end lines. And then you look into the announcement and most of them were level 2 charger. There's not that much value added in level 2 chargers, and it's easy to get headlines because you can get thousands of stations for the price of a few DC fast charging stations. There's such a disparity between the price of a DC fast charging and between a level 2. But there's also giant disparities in how useful it is, because you already have a giant charging infrastructure in every home out there that has to, not everyone can get used with just a 120 volt charging, but a lot of people can. And then it's very easy to just upgrade to 240. And that's it. That's what most people need. What you need from a public charging infrastructure is enable me to do long distance travel. And that's DC fast charging. A lot of them in great position, but I don't think that's that big of a problem anymore. I think that was a problem like maybe 3-4 years ago. I think people got the message at this point, and we're hearing people more invest in that. Also, money wise, like if you're gonna charge for the charging, no pun intended, you can charge a lot more for DC fast charging. So you can deliver a lot more electricity a lot faster. So you can actually make money off of it instead of just a level 2 charging, which can be good for like restaurants or things like that, that just have like a trickle charge where you eat there or something. But
I wouldn't even say restaurants, more like hotels.
Yeah, hotels is the best. Yeah.
All right. I think that's about it from the questions.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for listening, everyone. Thanks a lot for watching on YouTube, Facebook, and all your apps. If you can give us a like and a follow there, it's always appreciated. And we're going to see you same place, same time next week. Have a good one.